Well, guys, welcome to, of course, the Lethal Mullet Podcast here tonight for episode number 201. That's right, we're up to 201. Call this the second season of the Lethal Mullet. That's right, the second lot of 100 we're going to go through. And, of course, what we're going to be looking at this is today, one of the more interesting films out there, which, of course, has a whole franchise behind it. It's an animated film, which now also led to, of course, two and now three theatrical outings, and which weren't exactly cracking it at the box office, but the toys continue to rock and roll. And that is, of course, G.I. Joe, the movie, or the animated feature, as we say. Joining me today is the world's biggest G.I. Joe fan, all the way from, of course, Bradenton in Florida. That's Florida for you guys out there listening to the music. And, of course, that is Kyle Wagner of FPN. How are you, man?
I am doing good. I'm here to get a little yo-jo on, but no Cobra Law.
No Cobra Law. And I'll tell you what, this is interesting because we get the character of Serpenter.
Oh, well, you know, this is an interesting film to talk about because we're going to be talking about the 1987 G.I. Joe, the movie animated feature, which came out after Hasbro did Transformers, the movie, which had a very big impact on G.I. Joe, the animated film. And even more so than the Transformers film, G.I. Joe, the movie, ended up being kind of a wrap-up for that classic run of 1980s G.I. Joe cartoons. They did a spin-off, a Joe cartoon, a little later that carried off kind of a sequel. But, yeah, this was an interesting project, and this was a kind of a sign of the times changing for a lot of the major 1980s toy franchises that were based having these toy lines and animated series based off of each other. We were seeing the wind down of Transformers. We were seeing the wind down of G.I. Joe, of Mask, the real Ghostbusters. You were seeing kind of the rise up of some new ones like Brave Star and some of the toy lines that tried to get out at the end of the 1980s. But this really was kind of the ending for those two major story toy lines and stories in Transformers and G.I. Joe.
It's an interesting time. I mean, obviously, the 80s was all about advertising the merchandise and putting it out into these cartoons, you know, basically animating what the kids were playing with. And we have George Lucas to blame for a lot of that, of course, because, you know, he made the very expensive advertisements to get his toys out, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that started it all. Star Wars really kind of broke the bank on that. Kind of followed up, honestly, more by He-Man, I think, than anything else. And then G.I. Joe and Transformers shortly thereafter. And I remember both in the aspect of Transformers and G.I. Joe, they started off as miniseries. Of course, the classic Mass Device for G.I. Joe, which then was followed up a little bit later by the Revenge of Cobra. And then they started the regular weekly G.I. Joe series. And then they did it finally a third. They did two more five-part things, the Temple of Darkness and then the Rise, Serpentor, Arise. And then the G.I. Joe movie itself was very weird because it was expecting a theatrical release. It maybe got a very limited theatrical release. A lot of people didn't see it till it actually debuted on regular television. And I know I was living in Alaska at the time, and it debuted on Superstation WGN out of Chicago, Illinois, on a Sunday afternoon. And I didn't even know about it. My parents actually brought it to my attention. So they said, "Do you know about this G.I. Joe movie? We just saw that." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And sure enough, and so I actually watched it when they premiered it on WGN, which was about the same time it was in hitting a very, very, very limited theatrical release. I think it's had larger theatrical releases later on through Fathom Events here in the United States. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things about this particular movie that just people talk about to this day.
It's interesting, you know, it's obviously had a cable TV and VHS release in most neck of the woods when it comes to, you know, the release schedule itself. Out here in Australia, the first time I saw the animated feature available for sale was probably about 88, maybe 89, and it was in a Woolworths, which is our supermarkets out here in Australia. And I do remember, actually, a funny story, Kevin being out here in 2017. And he goes, "Yeah, they got Woolworths here." I said, "Yeah, they do have Woolworths here." He goes, "They've got Woolworths here." There you go. There's a bit of a story for you.
I had a Woolworths. That's where I got a lot of my G.I. Joe figures growing up in Alaska. We had a Woolworths. We had two Woolworths and then a local, what they called a co-op. And those were the two places I mainly got my G.I. Joe figures from. There's a couple other places. Pay and Save was one. We had a Fred Meyer for a while. But as far as the G.I. Joe of that particular that era, it was the Co-op or World Wars were the places that you could really find the G.I. Joe figures. And again, it was such a fun time, especially if you were growing up in that age where you kind of had the comic book, the toy, the cartoon tie-in. So you had all this stuff just blasting you in the face, especially with that Marvel Hasbro Sunbo triangle thing that they had going on for both Transformers and G.I. Joe. And so, you know, you really got a lot of that going at you. And I mean, I think when you talk about syndicated cartoons, because everybody forgets that G.I. Joe and Transformers were not traditional Saturday morning cartoons. They were weekday afternoon, after school cartoons. And so they were syndicated. So they weren't, they had longer runs. They had more episode counts. I think G.I. Joe officially went on for 3 seasons, I believe it was, maybe a short 4th season. But of course, you know, the show changed around every time a new wave of toys came out. They had to introduce the new characters, some of the older characters getting a little more phased out or pushed to the background. So it was very interesting to see that, and like the difference in the comics, especially like when you talk about one of the more popular G.I. Joe characters in Snake Eyes, because Snake Eyes was incredibly popular in the comic, obviously in the live action films, he was a very popular character. He had a pretty big role in the first couple of G.I. Joe miniseries that they put out, but then he kind of faded in the background once the TV show started because he wasn't a character who talked. And they didn't really know how to handle that. And he really hadn't gotten deep into the ninja roots of Snake Eyes at that point. So Snake Eyes ends up kind of becoming a background character the further along the G.I. Joe character, the cartoon goes along. You see Duke more front and center, Scarlet more front and center, and then Lady J and Flint, and then later on like Shipwreck and some of those other Joes with a little bit more personality. So.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think what's interesting is with Australia, we had both, you know. We had obviously one of the big things in the series was how it played in Australia, how it played in the UK. In the UK, of course, had Action Force, which was what it was relabeled to. But out here in Australia, we got both sets of merchandising sent out. So the first time I actually saw Snake Eyes was in an Action Force annual. It was about 1987 or 88. And it was, yes, Action Force as in G.I. Joe. But it was partially, though, they had a little comic at the start, like a little 5-page comic. And then you would have 3 or 4 British World War II stories. Another one on Merrill's Marauders. And then all of a sudden you'd have the Hiss tank, or you'd have, you know, some type of the A-10 Warthog that they had in there. And these would be shots of the toys. And it was basically an advertisement, right? Then you'd have a Snake Eyes comic. And that's the first time I saw him. It was in red, white, and purple. Really bizarre colors, but that's what it was. And he had his outfit, but he wasn't carrying a sword. He was carrying an Uzi. Right, it was that real commando sort of style of it.
Yeah, and that was the first Snake Eyes figure had that. He had no sword. Mm-hmm. It was the Uzi and a satchel of charges. And then it wasn't until the second Snake Eyes figure where they changed up his mask a little bit, gave him the sword, gave him Timber the Wolf, and that really started reflecting a little bit more of the ninja style of Snake Eyes in that aspect.
And it was great. Look, it was really a great little comic. Towards the end of it, you got to know, of course, all the mains. We had Cobra Commander in both his face-plated mirror version, but also in his basically that little handkerchief that he puts on his head. You know, it's the same sort of idea, which I always thought was bloody stupid, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I think too what's kind of interesting is when you look at the differences between like the comics and the cartoon show. The comics got a little bit more adult themed than the cartoon shows did, but the cartoon shows created such a rich world themselves. Like for instance, Cobra Commander. We think we see him meet his final fate in G.I. Joe the movie, but then there is in the final season of Transformers that came out after the Transformers the movie film, which takes place in a little bit of the future. They come across a character who's voiced obviously by the same actor who does Starscream for Cobra Commander. He also did Cobra Commander, and they basically hint that it was Cobra Commander manipulating a couple of the Transformers, and so they kind of had a little tie-in of that universe, but without actually showing it to be Cobra Commander. But at the end, there's a nice little Easter egg that basically reveals that to possibly be the case. But what's interesting about these two, about G.I. Joe the movie, and much like and it's a little different from what Transformers the movie did, because Transformers the movie happened and then they had another season that took place introducing, carrying over all the characters that were introduced in Transformers the movie, because you had such a change. G.I. Joe the movie, that was it for that particular run of the Marvel Hasbro grouping. There was a new show later, but it was nowhere near as good. It was a different animation house. The animation was terrible. It was a really rough story, but it reflected like a couple of the waves of G.I. Joe figures that came out after that G.I. Joe the movie. But really, a lot of people kind of feel like that G.I. Joe the movie was the end of that particular era of G.I. Joe the animated series.
Oh, without a doubt. Now, folks, before we get into the movie and chat about what is so, you know, prestigious about it, we're going to let you know how to catch this show and many others like it. If you look at the ticker at the below the screen, you'll see you can check all of these out at lethalmelonnetwork.podbean.com or on the Podbean app. You can also check it out at any good place that you can, of course, subscribe to podcasts. On this as well, you can find us at The Lethal Melon on all forms of social networking. And, of course, Kyle, where can we find you?
You can find me all over the Fandom Podcast Network, whether it's at the audio homepage at fpnet.podbean.com, on our own YouTube channel, just search for the Fandom Podcast Network. Of course, you can find me on our Facebook page, Fandom Podcast Network, on the Facebook, Twitter, at FanPod Network. Of course, you can find me on my own social medias, on Twitter, at AKyleW, or on Instagram, at AKyleFandom.
Awesome, awesome. All right, folks, let's get into what this movie is all about. Now, this is an interesting one because not only is it giving us, obviously the characters that we know, but it's giving us some new stuff as well. The movie came out as, of course, G.I. Joe the movie and also Action Force the movie in the UK in 1987. It was directed video, and, of course, the topic and genre is, of course, military science fiction, to do with a toy series, of course. And it is, of course, the sequel to the animated series, of course, G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, which we all saw as a kid down here in the 80s. And, of course, it's based on Hasbro's toys. It was brought together by Sunbow Productions and, of course, Marvel Productions, and it was animated by Toei Animation in Japan. This is at the height of its popularity, and I don't think it's ever been quite as popular since. But, of course, all in times to, the popularity of the Transformers movie being out there too. And from there, we also had, of course, My Little Pony, the movie, and others hot in the wake of it, of course, when it comes to toys and all that sort of stuff. This certainly was something that got split up, wasn't it, Kyle, into, a series of daily episodes when they wanted to break it down for TV?
Yeah, they eventually did break this down to, I believe it was either a 4 or 5 part episode. A little bit of weird editing involved with that, but that's always the case because this was designed to be a movie. This was originally filmed and cut as a film. So eventually they did cut it down to air as a weekly 5 part special. But in truth, it's best watched in the movie format without the TV cuts in between. Animation wise, it's one of the best G.I. Joe things ever animated. I truly believe that. And it's interesting because I think while on one hand it is at maybe the height, getting close, you're at the height of G.I. Joe, you're also looking at kind of it starting to decline because they were kind of starting to get a little bit more fantastical with their ideas. Things were getting a little bit more out there with the design of some of the military vehicles and things like that were getting a little bit more like, okay, this is maybe even a little more advanced than what we have in our own military right now. And so, and then you add in the aspect, and if you talk to most G.I. Joe fans, they will have a little bit of a cringe when they come hear the name Cobra Law. And it was a concept that was introduced in towards the end of G.I. Joe where it was a 3-character figure pack with, the Cobra Law soldier, Nemesis Enforcer, and Globulus, who was the leader of Cobra Law. At the same time, they were also released Sergeant Slaughter's Renegades, I believe it was, which were the 3 characters that were introduced that were paired with Sergeant Slaughter in the G.I. Joe movie, along with Lieutenant Falcon, who spent a lot of time in the quote-unquote slaughterhouse after some things he had done. But it was definitely the start of the decline of G.I. Joe. And again, too, we had just a year earlier in 86, we had Transformers the movie come out. And there were several things that happened in Transformers the movie that very much impacted why G.I. Joe did not make it into theaters and why there was a couple of huge plot changes in G.I. Joe the movie. the movie. One of those, Adam, and one of the biggest things, and is that I'm going to bring it up now, is when Optimus Prime was killed in Transformers the movie, they did not expect the impact it had on children. And I think for a lot of children of that time period, they kind of grew up with Optimus Prime as almost like a secondary type father figure, because everybody loved Optimus Prime. Peter, the amazing Peter Cullen voicing him, to just he was always the kind of the essential. And there was a very traumatizing emotional response by children to the death of Optimus Prime, as well as the death of several other key Transformers figures in this. Now, again, it's done by a Japanese animation house. They are used to that more of a violent style, and it was an easy way for them to explain why they've ended the doing. They had lost the licenses, had ended on those original Transformer figure runs, but that's why they were bringing in these new characters. Well, we get to G.I. Joe the movie, and there's a famous scene in this where Duke is fighting Serpentor, and Serpentor throws a snake directly into Duke's heart, but Duke just falls into a coma. And at the end at the end of the G.I. Joe movie, when they're all celebrating, you hear the voice actor, one of the voice actors say, Doc just checked in. Duke's come out of his coma. We never see Duke. You never see him again. But, you know, the implication was Duke dies. The original plan was for Duke to die in the film, and hence the handoff to his half-brother, Lieutenant Falcon, which was, of course, in the film, voiced by the famous Don Johnson. But because Hasbro and the toy line people were so uncomfortable with how the reaction to the death of Optimus Prime was, they basically said, nope, not doing that. It's going to be a coma.
At least he's still alive. And with that, let's have a look at a bit of the plot here, and we're going to get right into it because there's quite a bit to the plot of this film and lots of characters. All right, so Cobra Commander and Serpentor are basically in competition for basically the leadership of Cobra, and trying to find out why, between the two of them, who is the root cause of why everything is failing. Pythonna, a woman who's from a secret civilization, as we've mentioned, called Cobra Law, gets into the Terror Drone, and from here reveals to Serpentor that Cobra Law was responsible for inspiring Dr. Mindbender to create Serpentor. And of course, this is all through dreams and, of course, suggestions, stuff like that. She's basically a witch. And from there, Serpentor plans to take out and capture the Broadcast Energy Transmitter, or the BET. From here, Cobra assaults the Joes and tries to test the BET in the Himalayas. And of course, the Joes use the BET to activate automated weapon systems on there. Serpentor is captured, and of course, Cobra Commander orders a retreat. This is a hell of an opening, isn't it?
Oh, the opening to G.I. Joe the movie, the opening quote-unquote credits, is one of the coolest G.I. Joe animated moments of all time. You can find it on YouTube, just the opening credits, and it's absolutely just stunning. It's amazing. It's like, why couldn't this movie be more of what this was instead of what we got with this film, which is this crazy fantasy science fiction where we find out that Cobra Commander came from this world of Cobra Law, which has like been around for millions of years with this society that's, you know, more natural and tied in with like these giant insects and prehistoric insects, and that Cobra Commander maybe had this accident which deformed him and gave him like multiple eyes from the look of it. He became on to go into the world as the representative of Cobra Law to try to reestablish Cobra Law into the world. Obviously, it didn't go well. In the comics, the idea of Serpentor was that Destro and Dr. Mindbender were kind of fed up with Cobra Commander's antics. They wanted to create the perfect leader for Cobra, so they went out and got the DNA of many famous leaders throughout history, combined them and created Serpentor. Well, in the movie, we find out that actually Dr. Mindbender was influenced by Cobra Law technology to come up with the idea of Serpentor, because he was too stupid really to actually come up with the idea of Serpentor himself. So that leads to that leads to Cobra finding Cobra Law. The Joes, a group of Joes with a lot of the classic Joes like Snake Eyes and Roadblock, Snow Job, a lot of those early Joes getting captured while trying to chase Cobra into Cobra Law, with only Roadblock escaping but being blinded, and Cobra Commander exposed to this like mutagen that actually ends up by the end of the film turning him into a full-blooded snake. So that side of the movie, and of course Cobra, what this mutagen is also the kind of one of the tropes of this, is that Cobra Law plans to spread this mutagen all over the planet and launch it into space. And then G.I. Joe has built this, what they call the BET, and it's this energy transmitter, and the Cobra Law needs this to energize the spores so they transform everybody across the planet. So that's your, that kind of your deus machina there for what the plot is. Of course, into classic G.I. Joe fashion, we have several new characters introduced, mainly with the Cobra Law side, which I'll get to in a minute. But on the Joe side, you have a character named Big Lob, who's this big sports fan. You have Jinx, the famous G.I. Joe female ninja. You have Chuckles, who is an undercover agent, very quiet in the show. I don't think he speaks, but maybe one word, if that. You have another character by the name of Tunnel Rat. And Tunnel Rat is actually a very famous G.I. Joe character because he was designed to look like the famous G.I. Joe writer Larry Hama. So there's a lot of that. And then, of course, you had Lieutenant Falcon, who's kind of the next in line between Duke, Flint, Admiral Hawk, and of course now you have Lieutenant Falcon, and of course at the time famously voiced by Don Johnson, who I think if you listen to his performance was basically there to get a paycheck. And but the other big member of G.I. Joe at the time, and he had been introduced in the prior season of G.I. Joe, the season they created the Serpentor, is Sergeant Slaughter, the professional wrestler who had this huge tie-in to G.I. Joe, All-American hero, everything like this. And the crazy thing is, shortly after the G.I. Joe movie came out, he turned heel in professional wrestling and became an Iraqi sympathizer. So,
yo, Joe.
And they were still airing G.I. Joes with him in it and stuff like that. So that was kind of a bit of a mind trip. But on the Cobra side, this is where things get interesting, because you had a lot of the basic classic Cobra characters, but you had these Cobra Law characters. You had this Pythona, who was strictly created for the movie as a female character. Very interesting. You had Nemesis Enforcer, who is an action figure in this Cobra Law playset, kind of your big muscle bound thing. And again, very much like Transformers, the movie, you had an acting legend voice the main villain. In Transformers, it was the final performance for Orson Welles. And I don't believe it was his final performance, but one of his final performances, the great Burgess Meredith voicing Globulus as the leader of Cobra Law and apparently the true founder of Cobra. So it's a mind trip that two of the greatest actors of maybe all time, some of their final roles were these animated toys, shows based off of toys for kids. And
considering like G.I. Joe even had a Balboa at one stage, like toy. So yeah. You could go, hey, yo, Mick. Hey, yo, Mick.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really, truly kind of insane of just how things went with that. Bear with me for a minute, because I'm checking something here. Yeah, see, Burgess Meredith passed away in 1996. So it was he lived for about 9 more years after this, but he really didn't have to do much. This was, he was in Grumpier Old Men. He did some flashbacks as Mickey and Rocky V, but really G.I. Joe, the movie, was one of his last really big roles. He had a couple up episodes of In the Heat of the Night as well, which is a very popular TV show. But yeah, for a lot of people, he's kind of his last remembered thing was Globulus. And so yeah, you have Orson Welles, which Transformers, the movie, his voicing of Unicron was the last role he ever had. And then you have Burgess Meredith, who a lot of people consider like the last role they remember him in was doing this. So
100%. Yeah, folks, I'm going to riddle off some of the names here, and we're definitely going to be stopping on a few, because guess what? It has in some of these roles some very close ties to Hasbro material, but also others as well. So Charlie Adler plays Lowlight. Shuko Okune plays Jinx. Jack Angel is Wetsuit. Jackson Beck is the narrator of the series and, of course, the movie. Michael Bell as Duke, Zamot, Blowtorch, and Lift Ticket. Also Greg Berger as Motor Viper. Earl Bowen, folks. And if you don't know that name, you might want to look it up. Earl Bowen is, of course, the psychiatrist from The Terminator. Yes, the one that keeps telling Sarah that she's not seeing things. She's not seeing anything. It's all in her head. We also have Arthur Burkhart as Destro. Corey Burton. Now, there's a name, folks. Corey Burton as Tomax. And, of course, we have William Calloway as Beachhead. Beachhead's one of my more favorite characters. He's basically your big drill sergeant. He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's great. Of course, we're coming up on it. The great Peter Cullen voiced Xandar, who was Took as well. Yeah, I mean, basically, if you grew up in the 80s, you recognize a lot of the voices that were in this movie or did voices on Transformers or G.I. Joe, because a lot of them kind of bounced back and forth between the shows doing different character voices. Obviously, like I said, Peter Cullen, the great Peter Weller, or not Peter Weller, Frank Welker. It's kind of a who's who. And this is before voice actors were truly fully recognized in what they are today, like the great Richard Epcar, who I know you just had on an episode of Lethal Mullet. But voice actors at this time hadn't been recognized like they are now. And it's kind of a shame because we had so many good voice actors at this time.
We really do. Obviously, Sergeant Slaughter is Sergeant Slaughter. But the one that sticks out too here is a alumni of course, the great, of course, Robotech. And that is, of course, Michael McConaughey, who plays cross-country in this. Now, Michael is, if I do remember, also in Transformers as well, Samurai Champloo. He was in Bobo. And, of course, he plays Rolf Emerson in, of course, the Masters era of one of my more favorite characters. Rolf Emerson always got the fat end of the big end of the stick, put it that way. He always copping it from, of course, his management. And, of course, then, you know, all of his troops copped it in the end. Again, the second series of Robotech doesn't get enough love, folks. I think it needs to get more. Considering it's got the best mech, the hover tank. That thing is freaking amazing. And we need to see that made again. Just like these bad boys that we're getting here now from, of course, the Macross saga as well. But yeah, so we've got some great characters there, obviously, in this series. And I think no doubt that's what led a lot to it too. Now, what's interesting too about this is, I think, you know, as much as it is trying to sell as many toys as possible in one thing, a lot of people started to get their own character that they love. You know, obviously Tunnel Rat's beloved character, without a doubt. But I think Snake Eyes after this was the character that everyone turned to.
Oh, Snake Eyes was the character everybody loved because of his cool look and then just the way Larry Hama wrote Snake Eyes in the G.I. Joe classic Marvel G.I. Joe comic. And of course, tying him to Storm Shadow. It's kind of funny because Storm Shadow's big rival in the cartoon series was actually the Indian Spirit, who was the tracker for the G.I. Joe team, had his Eagle Freedom. They kind of started establishing that rivalry early on in the G.I. Joe cartoon myth lore with the Revenge of Cobra, where Storm Shadow and Spirit faced off, and it wouldn't be the first or the last time that they faced off throughout the series. But really, they never, the cartoon from the 80s never really put a big focus on Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes like other cartoon projects for G.I. Joe have since then, or the live action G.I. Joe films.
Oh, without a doubt. I think what's interesting too is, like, as you mentioned, like, it's definitely the best of the animated ones. And I remember, as I said before, I've been able to see it thanks to simply just going to Woolworths and they had the slipcover version VHS. Now, if you got that, you got a free vehicle from G.I. Joe. And I can't remember the one I had. It was a Cobra vehicle. It was basically a big M1 Abrams-style tank that it was squashed lid. And when the turret came up, it exposed the armored car that would come out of it as well. And that was like probably about $15. It was a toy that would retail for about $100.
Yeah.
So they were trying to flog off a lot of stuff in the late 80s because Mask had come along and pretty much killed the market.
Well, see, this is where, like I said, it gets interesting on the toy side, because whereas with G.I. Joe, after the movie, they still had a few lines come out. The figures, things were getting really weird with the figures because they were starting to go into like these neon bright colors. You had Battle Force 2000, which a lot of people kind of feel like that was kind of the end of G.I. Joe losing any military reality to it. and things like that. Transformers had another whole line, a couple of major big popular lines after the movie. Obviously, you had all the characters from the Transformers, the movie, like Hot Rod and Cup and Ultra Magnus. And then even afterwards, that's when they introduced the Headmasters, the Target Masters, and a few other pretty well-known characters from their world. G.I. Joe, it kind of hit its peak, I think, as far as figure-wise, right after this film, because they had a whole nother run of figures where they had, you got a G.I. Joe version of Storm Shadow, you had a new version of Snake Eyes, you got a new version of the classic character Stalker, which was kind of in an Arctic motif. You had some characters like Hit and Run, Bushido, a few others after that had some of a following thanks to the G.I. Joe comic. But it was shortly after that, the things really petered out. You had some things happen in the G.I. Joe comic, including the death of several classic G.I. Joes in a particular issue of G.I. Joe, where it's become kind of famous because I believe it's 5 Joes that were killed. And I mean, a couple of them were pretty popular G.I. Joes that had been there since the start. So it was kind of the winding down of G.I. Joe. And for the most part, during that time frame afterwards, G.I. Joe kind of stayed quiet. There was a couple of anniversaries where G.I. Joe got popular again on the toy lines. There was a couple of different G.I. Joe cartoons that came out. There was G.I. Joe Extreme, I think, was one of them. There was a second G.I. Joe film that was kind of a direct follow-up to the movie, but very rough follow-up. There was a G.I. Joe, I think it was G.I. Joe Resolute, that was a Cartoon Network. It only ran for about 45 minutes total, but it was a very short, like 10-minute-a-day episode shorts. That is absolutely phenomenal, and I will tell anybody that they need to check that out if you can find that. That was phenomenal, great Snake Eyes Storm Shadow story, but some interesting stuff going on with G.I. Joe as well. G.I. Joe has become really forefront again now with the new G.I. Joe Classified line that Hasbro is putting out. The biggest problem with that is good luck finding it in the stores, but they're a larger figure. They're actually not the 3¾-inch. They're, I believe, a 6-inch figure, and they're very beautifully done, and they're absolutely gorgeous figures. I've bought a few of them myself, but they are very hard to come by, and your best bet is actually through online, through Hasbro Pulse, but they sell out so fast that you can't. It's hit or miss whether you can get it. And I know there's been we had the two G.I. Joe films. I think the second one is probably the superior film of the two with The Rock. But they've just never really been able to get things off the ground. I know we had IDW take over the G.I. Joe comics line from Marvel, and they actually even brought Jim Lee back and had him continue writing the storylines that he had in Marvel as a second G.I. Joe comic book, which just recently came to an end. IDW is actually losing the G.I. Joe and Transformers licenses here shortly, so they're going to be up for grabs again. I'll be curious to see where they could end up. But it's very much a interesting time frame for both G.I. Joe and Transformers, two very popular 80s toy lines. But like I said, the G.I. Joe movie is kind of one of those flagpole moments in G.I. Joe history. And what for better or worse, because there's people who are going to roll their eyes at the story of G.I. Joe the movie, but there's things that stand out about it. And the animation quality is one of those. This was done by a Japanese animation with Toei Animation. It is beautifully animated, Adam.
Oh, yeah. It's just gorgeous. I mean, Toei just seemed to be hitting it in all strides, whether it's live action stuff over there. They've always done well. You know, it's without a doubt, the biggest, production house in Japan at the time, you know. And which makes it, you know, a group of talented artists that just know how to really deliver, and they bloody well do. I mean, I would say it's not shy of being as good as Akira in forms of, you know, animation quality. And it is. I mean, it's a lot brighter. It's not as obviously dark a material as Akira. You know, it's a kid's animation, but certainly makes it interesting. All right, folks, we're going to get into some trivia here now and just where things were going. So the movie was produced by the same company at the same time as obviously Transformers the movie, which we've talked about earlier. Production had actually begun on G.I. Joe first, and then, of course, expected to be able to be put out earlier than the Transformers one. But of course, with some changes, and of course the changes that Kyle mentioned, it was put out later and not killing, obviously, Duke goes into a coma. Here's another one for you we've talked about before. Cobra Law was not intended to be in the movie. The writers planned to replace that when they had a better name for the actual Hasbro items. So what would they have called it?
You know, I have not heard of the name because I don't think they ever were able to come up with a better name. It's such a weird faction and weird creation that really just, to be honest with you, it never really fit into G.I. Joe as far as how they explained it in the movie. Now, for the toy line, if I'm remembering correctly, and I might not be, if anybody out there wants to correct me, please feel free. They described Cobra Law as a scientific experiment gone bad.
Oh, that's right. When Sergeant Slaughter uses the term ditty bag to illustrate Lieutenant Falcon's prep, pass or fail, ditty is a term for do-it-yourself. So when a soldier processes from an installation for discharge or other assignments, it is ditty, do-it-yourself. In addition to being killed off by earlier drafts, one draft of the script featured a funeral for Duke. Now, as we've talked about this earlier, how do you think that would have gone now?
I think they would have probably done it now compared to back then. This actually is another interesting piece of trivia because mindful that the television series was being compared unfavorably to Robotech for its sanitized depiction of combat, the producers decided to have a death scene for Duke to give the movie a harder edge. But the upper management forced them to add a line saying he only went into a coma. Again, this coming from the fact that the reaction to the death of Optimus Prime traumatized so many kids. We need to be honest about the fact that, I mean, you know, when you're trying to compare it to Robotech, Robotech was a totally different monster, and Robotech didn't have the broadcast range that G.I. Joe did at the time.
It's a completely different thing, isn't it? I mean, it's like comparing apples and oranges, really, isn't it? Globulus, it's a mouthful, isn't it? Globulus, Nemesis Enforcer, and Royal Guard were part of a three-pack that we mentioned earlier. And Pythona did not receive a figure until Collectors Club had released one in 2016. Mm-hmm. Interesting. You think they would have just released one of every character in this movie?
Yeah, you would think. But again, this was at a time too where the mindset about female characters in this kind of line was dealt with differently. At the time, I think we had four female characters in G.I. Joe released as figures. You had Scarlet, you had Cover Girl who came with the Wolverine missile tank, you had the Baroness, and you had Jinx, I think, were the only female characters that were released in Lady J. So you had five. So you that were released out of all of those characters. But to give you an idea too of some of the craziness with Lieutenant Falcon, who was kind of the center of attention in this, he was originally written to be the son of General Hawk. And because Falcon was seen as kind of a screw up, when they did a later G.I. Joe animated series, which became kind of like this thing where it was G.I. Joe's war on drugs, Lieutenant Falcon actually becomes addicted to drugs given to him by one of G.I. Joe's enemies, the headman, and he has to go through rehab.
Oh, it's funny how that peels down, isn't it? Crazy. Now, one of the other things, too, about this series is that, you know, Duke is a first sergeant portrayed as the leader of the Joes, and a first sergeant in E8 is a non-com officer. However, he still gives orders to his brother, Lieutenant Falcon, or a lieutenant, as we call him out here. So, what do you think of that? The ranks were all over the place.
Oh, yeah, it was crazy because even if you go back into the first General Hawk figure was actually part of the original line of G.I. Joe toys that came out. He came with the mobile missile system. And then Duke originally came out as a mail-in character. And you would get like flag points and you'd send them in, and like for $4.95 or something, you could get the Duke action figure. And then later on, the Duke action figure was released in stores. But when the first animated series came out, there was no General Hawk. It was Duke who was in charge, and they didn't bring General Hawk in until they actually did the Rise Sepentor Arise miniseries. So in the meantime, too, Duke took a backseat to Flint for a while as the leader. Flint seemed to be always in the one in charge of G.I. Joe, and Duke showed up for like the big stuff. And then you had General Hawk show up, and then I remember there was actually an episode in that run of G.I. Joe where Cobra sent some false orders to G.I. Joe promoting like three of the most oddball Joes. But they show like the G.I. Joe leadership triangle, and you've got like General Hawk at the top, and then you have like Duke and Flint like right next to each other. And then you below them, you've got like Beachhead, Sergeant Slaughter, and I think it's one other character. And it was like, it was interesting to see how the triangle of leadership took place in G.I. Joe.
Oh, 100%. And, it, you know, again, it's confusing if you look at it from a a true military perspective, I guess, you know, in some ways that way too. What is your favorite action set piece in this?
That's a good question. There is a final battle scene between Falcon and Serpentor that's really well done, where they're in Cobra Law, but there's a really beautiful animation scene where they're the BET, the energy thing, they need to get it to explode, and there's this thing they do with Falcon and Jinx and Sergeant Slaughter, and it's just so well animated that it's just very pretty to look at. There's also the battle scene where G.I. Joe invades Cobra Law, that's and the Globulus activates all the creatures within Cobra Law to defend it. That's pretty well done, but it's creepy as heck too, because they're all insects and these weird living type creatures and stuff like that.
You know, it's interesting because it's magical. And in some ways, I compare that to Suicide Squad, the first movie, where they bring the supernatural element into things, you know, and it's things that work in an animated format that probably wouldn't lend itself to the likes of a live action, you know. And I think that's, you know, an interesting way of making your characters work together towards a common topic. Now, Kevin Reitzel's favorite character is in this. Of course, we talked a little bit about him before, Chuckles. But he doesn't get a line in the movie.
No, he doesn't. And this has kind of led to some bizarre things between the Chuckles in the comics and how some people portray Chuckles. But yeah, Chuckles not getting a line in the movie is just kind of weird, because that's really not the character.
No, 100%. And what is your favorite character out of the movie?
Out of the movie, I kind of like the Jinx character. I thought that was I enjoyed that. I mean, the focus is so much on Sergeant Slaughter and Falcon and the Renegades, and I've always been a big Roadblock fan too, and he got a pretty good run in this film as well.
I mean, and the vehicles too in this are quite amazing. What's your favorite one?
This is good. This is kind of a thing, because by this time, the Joe vehicles were getting a little ridiculous. I need to be honest. you had the Havoc going on. You had the Tomahawk helicopters, which were pretty cool. But to me, I still got to go. As far as my favorite Joe vehicles, you got to go back to some of the classic Joe vehicles from when G.I. Joe first came out. You had the Whale hovercraft, which was phenomenal. I was a big fan of the Battle Bear snow machine that the Joes had. And of course, you can't go wrong with the Sky Striker plane. I preferred those actually to the Conquest, which you see in G.I. Joe the movie. But it's at this point, the vehicle designs were a little weird and a little different. I think one you did see in this movie was the Snowcat, which I was another a fan of as well. But yeah, I mean, if you're on the talking about the Cobra side, you always have fun with the Cobra battle pod, AKA the Trouble Bubble.
I love it. And the fact that, you know, then, of course, people want to go out in the stores and actually buy this stuff, you know, it's crazy. I'm going to say, look, I love Falcon in this, you know, a very naive soldier who, you know, obviously has to accept responsibility. And that's part of what this story is about. And, you know, very much what a lot of G.I. Joe is about is, you know, owning your life, owning your mistakes and opportunities, and, of course, bettering yourself.
Yeah, I think with Falcon, the storyline for the character was very well done. Again, it comes down to the fact you have Don Johnson voicing him. And I think they just pulled Don Johnson to get a famous name. But you could kind of tell Don Johnson was kind of mailing in this for a paycheck. His emotional range was not very wide in this role. I would have liked to have seen somebody who's more of a traditional voice actor get the role and carry it on, but they needed names to sell it. I mean, you look at like Transformers, the movie, they had some big names voicing some of the new characters in that, whether it was Judd Nelson as Hot Rod, you had Robert Stack as Ultra Magnus, Leonard Nimoy as Galvatron, obviously Orson Welles,
Eric Idle.
Metron. I mean, mm-hmm. So you had some big names in the Transformers, the movie, and you have here, you have Burgess Meredith, but you still needed another one. And they got Don Johnson, who I don't even know if he felt right for the voice to be the voice of Falcon personally.
100%. Now, wrapping up, where would you like to see the series go next?
I think they're on a very strong run right now with the Classified toy line. I think that's a very well done toy line. Their distribution sucks, I'm going to be honest with you, as far as how they're handling getting it out in stores and its availability to find. I'm not quite. There's really nothing much on the animated side. I really think the focus might be to figure out a way to get another live action film done. Obviously, we just had the Snake Eyes G.I. Joe, the origin movie, which was terrible. You don't put the guys from the Raid in a movie and don't have them do martial arts for 3 minutes. It was Andrew Koji, who plays Storm Shadow in that film, is phenomenal, and he's really good. But I think there was a lot of disappointment from G.I. Joe fans from that movie. So I don't know where the franchise handles right now, but I think a lot of the Hasbro products are up in the air as far as their future on the big screen or on the television. I know, like, another one of the big Hasbro project toy lines from that time, Mask, has been bantered about for a very long time in a feature film kind of way. And there has been at times rumors of people who were associated with the Fast and Furious doing the work on that film, which to me makes a lot of sense if you're talking Mask, but I just don't know if that's ever going to actually get off the ground. The last really huge thing for that Hasbro verse was their comic line, where they tried to create this universe with Transformers and G.I. Joe and Mask and Visionaries and Action Man into one like big universe tied through the comics. And I think that was eventually the plan for the films. And it just, after I think G.I. Joe 2 did not do that great at the box office, and then the hope of a reboot with the G.I. Joe, the Snake Eyes origin film, kind of fell very flat. It's really hurt the G.I. Joe franchise. I know that we are getting more Transformers films. The Bumblebee film was actually very successful, and a lot of people loved the opening Cybertron sequence in that film because they felt like that was the first time they'd seen the actual Transformers on screen in live action. And I know later in 2023, we are getting the new Transformers movie that Michael Bay is not being a part of, but it's continuing his storylines, but they are bringing in the Beast Machine, Beast Wars Transformers into this as well. Optimus Primal is going to be in this and a couple of the other Beast Wars, as well as the return of Optimus Prime, Bumblebee, and a few other Transformers. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. It's kind of in a nexus right now. I enjoy, as far as Transformers side, I enjoyed that Bumblebee film. I thought it was a lot of fun. John Cena was in it. Of course, Haley Steinfeld was in that. So I thought it was solid. We'll see where they go with that going forward. G.I. Joe, that's a whole other thing. I just don't know what direction in the plan is. The comic license is up for grabs right now. There's a lot of rumors that Marvel might make a run at it again. I think there's a sense of limbo right now, except for what Hasbro's doing with the classified line. I know they tried to bring back the 3 3/4 inch figures for a little bit. That didn't work out that well. I don't think they marketed it properly. I'd like to see them take another run at that. And as far as live action, you know, I have no problem bringing back The Rock to do another G.I. Joe film. I thought he was good in that one. I just think he's tied into other bigger plans at this moment. So I really don't know where the future of the G.I. Joe franchise is as far as on TV or in film.
It could go either way. And that's the thing is, like, if Marvel pick this up and run with it, no doubt they're going to really pump a lot of, money into it. And also, I mean, I think the franchise will sell toys again very well. You know, Hasbro will be rich. So long as they get the distribution right, folks, you know, that's one thing that they can't seem to get right.
I think the other key aspect of it is that whoever does, whatever they do with the G.I. Joe license, they've got to bring it back to a little bit more of its military roots. And yet you can have kind of the craziness of what Cobra was, but I think you have to have G.I. Joe feel a bit more military. And I think that's something that they need to really focus on there.
Without a doubt. What do you give this on the Hallenbeck scale out of 5?
I would give G.I. Joe the movie. This is, again, coming out of depending how old you were when the time this came out. I am a huge fan of Transformers, the movie. That's a 5 out of 5 film for me, but that's for a lot of personal reasons as well. G.I. Joe, the movie, realistically, I think if you are a minor G.I. Joe fan, it's probably a 2. I think if you grew up with G.I. Joe and you experienced this, it's probably a 3 to 3.5 on the scale. And again, it's one of these films that really falls into more of a personal opinion and your love of the fandom and probably a lot of nostalgia factors in it as well.
Big time, big time. Well, folks, I'll give it a 3. It is, one that I saw split apart in, obviously the animated series run. And it's still, again, a great big advertisement for toys that we really enjoyed back in, of course, the 1980s. So I want to thank Kyle for being on tonight, chatting about, of course, this great movie. And, of course, who better, folks? Who better to talk about this than, of course, FPN's co-founder and biggest G.I. Joe fan in Florida.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't know if I'm even the biggest G.I. Joe fan on the FPN. Kevin and I run close, but yeah, we're both huge G.I. Joe fans, and I know we love talking about G.I. Joe and definitely have a lot of fond memories growing up with those toys. So
nice. Might have to get you on here and chat about Retaliation.
Do we have to?
All right, folks. I want to thank you all out there for, of course, joining us for episode number 201, of course, G.I. Joe. We'll catch you next time. Same station, of course, same mullet. And, of course, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.